38. Memor was roaring out of control. The two other folk restrained her. She twisted and clawed at them. Their howls and wails blended together, even to Tananarive Bailey's ears as she ran toward the enormous thrashing things. Her folk attendants had scattered, not knowing what to do. They were backed against the walls, stunned into silence by Memor's deep growls. Tananarive could tell they were too afraid to leave and too afraid to do anything. She saw that a figure among them lurked under a cowl, a humanoid with a gray metallic head, carrying three ruby-red eyes that peered out from the cowl's shadows. A cyborg, she guessed, mind downloaded into a metal body. Such things had begun to manifest Earthside in the era when they had departed, so perhaps it was natural that an alien form of embodied Artilex should have manifested here in a bowl that was millions of years old. The cyborg had a crystal silicon carbide assembly, four arms, and sturdy legs. She had seen no artificial bodies in the bowl, but now here was one, an attendant to the folk, cowering like the rest against the pink living wall. Tananarive glanced at all those pressed against the walls, and now could tell they were all far too afraid, too devoted to the entire bowl system, ever to see any other future. A stasis state where nothing changed. Then there came a move from the folk. Bimor acted. He held his genetic sister in a firm embrace, while Asenoth did something at the back of Memor's head. Her great shape stopped writhing and shuddering, and then slowly eased, her arms going slack. Memor's eyes were distant, her face blank, breath long and heavy, a woof, woof Tananarive had not heard before. Her big, nimble, four-fingered hands twitched, but did nothing. Bimor turned from Memor, chuffing and labored, his face troubled. Blinking, he saw the humans and Syl.
"We now know what you Syl have been spreading."
His voice came from the barrel chest, low and threatening. Kort stepped forward, mild and calm, seeming utterly unafraid. Tananarive had met the alien Syl only moments before and was still trying to understand them. They were humanoid and walked with a fluid grace, their tan clothing adjusting itself to their movements. Quirt said,
"Glorian message came to human ship, the Sunseeker."
Bimor huffed, stamped around, clearly calling on outside Artilex, and thinking on what they said, and finally himself said,
"I am, yes, aware that our forward stations, orbiting from ahead of us, did not register the Glorian signals well, and bring them to the proper level of attention. A bureaucratic error, alas! These stations have had no true news for many kilo orbitals. They suffer from a sclerotic inability to adapt, to remain fresh."
Kurt said softly,
"We know so, sire."
Bimor ignored this status salute.
"These humans managed to get the glory and mischief to you, the vagrant and difficult Syl."
"It was important. Surely you can see so, sire. We spread such message through city speak."
Quirt spoke mildly, but with eyes steady.
"Then came more. Diagram of Bol's path. Much long history. Strange tales the Glorians know."
Bimor said,
"Annoying! You had no need to be familiar with such."
Quirt did not blink.
"Syl think opposite."
Then they got into a hot discussion Tananarive could not follow, so she stepped back a few paces into the comforting circle of humans. She had not realized, living so long among aliens whose social signals were strange and hard to register, what a simple warmth came from her own kind. After so long, it felt like a profound blessing. As the folk chatter waxed on around them, Bimor booming, Quirt's small voice in sliding syllables, she considered her fellow humans. This was so strange in itself that the mere phrase "fellow humans" said it all as she thought of it. She had competed for, and then signed on to Sunseeker, all for one solid purpose, to go to a distant star and begin a new civilization. Straight out, true enough, a species imperative, some had said, and so she had supposed. She did feel that then. She had stored her eggs, and planned to find a man who deserved them, and to do what she could in some distant land among the stars to bring humanity to a greater destiny. Yet now these fellow humans in their nervous chatting selves looked strange to her. Their rambling, whispered words, their ill-concealed yet clearly frightened eyeball-jittering glances, all these seemed both familiar and yet edged in strangeness. Cliff, for example, looked worn down, skinny, standard uniform but patched here and there, knees and elbows replaced, and tattered beyond easy recognition. Rough-cut beard, hair chopped into blunt wedges, a true wild man for many wearing days. Yet his eyes were watchful and quick, listening to his team and also sizing up the alien discussion going on a few paces away. He seemed somehow telescoped down a long range, so she could see him in a perspective she had never known. As a member of his species, he talked less than others and never stopped studying his surroundings. Watching him was to her now refreshment, consolation, peace. Best to leave that for later, though. You met the alien on your own terms, and what you took away might be unexpected. She had to use whatever perspective worked. So Tananarive turned to Irma, smiled, and did the ritual girl thing, and got the whole story in a few minutes. The Glorians had sent their own history of the bull's long trajectory, plus some cartoon threats to stay away from Glory. Apparently they had been surveying all their galactic neighborhood for a great long time while keeping electromagnetic silence. But now that the bull was steadily approaching, they resorted to a simple microwave signal train, and it told a truly ancient tale. An event the folk called the Great Shame was marked in the bull's path. The Sil wrote it in their architectural messages. Their new city rapidly rebuilt after the bird folk smashed it. The new Sil array of parks, plazas, streets, and structures held an agreed code. This conveyed a message other societies ringed around the great expanses of the bowl could see and use. Now everyone knew of the Great Shame. Tananarive asked, "And why is that important?" "Because the folk destroyed their own homeworld," Cliff said. "As we saw, Earth. It looks like they blundered into the Oort cloud, and their gravitational impulse nudged the dinosaur killer comet 65 million years ago.
"So life changed directions," Tananarive said, eyes distant. "Doomed the dinosaurs, but made us possible."
"Must be more," Irma said. "Must be."
Memor thrashed and called in long, strident shrieks. She raised her huge, thick-lipped mouth and made a warbling, keening sound. Bemor sheltered his sister twin through this and gathered himself, a big, hulking presence, and said to them all, "The Sil did not truly know what they were doing. This is the great shame, yes. Now that it is known, the task of us all is to make clear that it came from an earlier species, and so does not imply that the folk are responsible." Tananarive's eyes flared, eyebrows arched.
"Huh? Come on. This does not imply that the folk are responsible, but you caused it. And why is Memor so distressed?"
Bemor shuddered a bit, and in low bass tones said,
"She is in conversation with her, undermined. The great shame was merely a phrase to her. Now she has discovered that her undermined concealed its meaning, to preserve her balance."
"I thought you folk could view all your unconscious," Tananarive said.
"Not always."
Bemor hesitated. Then with a rustle of feathers that she now knew meant he had made a decision, went on,
"The proto-folk of that ancient era, who committed the great shame, were unwise. They returned to their home system, flush with triumphant contacts with scores of nearby worlds. The dynamics of their parent system were well known to them, but wrong. Their data was gathered when the second sun, our star now, was still in place, and perhaps they ventured too deeply into the large cloud of asteroids."
Tananarive was digesting this when Cliff frowned and said, "The bowl has one great commandment. Stability is all, right? Having this great shame is a contradiction you don't want to face. Is that what's making that one," a nod to Memor, "so crazy?" An awkward silence. Then Asenoth said,
"We folk differ from those who built the bowl. Those could not view their underminds. The vagrant forces that arise in underminds can be managed if the sunshine of the overmind shines upon them."
Tananarive said,
You think of your unconscious as like, say, bacteria? Sanitize it, problem solved?
Beemore and Osanoff looked at each other and exchanged fast, complex fan signals with clacking and rustling. Beemore had Memor in a restraining hold, and the big creature was slowly becoming less restive.
"Not knowing your desires renders them more potent," Beemore said. "They then emerge in strange ways, at unexpected moments. Your greatest drives lie concealed from your foreminds, so the running agents and subsystems of your immediate thinking persona can be invaded, without knowing it, by your underminds. Quite primitive."
"Which defeats control, right?" Cliff said.
"And so stability,"
Tan and Areev added. Osanoth said, "You mean, late invaders, that notions simply appear in your overminds?"
"You mean, do we have ideas?"
Tan and Areev considered.
"Sure."
"But you have no clue where the ideas came from,"
Osanoth said.
Beemore added, "Worse, they cannot go find where their ideas were manufactured. Much of their minds is barred to them."
"Astounding," Osanoth said. "Yet, it works in a way. They did get here on their own starship."
"There are many subtle aspects," Beemore began, and then paused. "We must keep to task."
He turned and gestured. Attendants rolled forward a large machine.
"I don't like the look of that," Tan and Areev said. "Is that the same machine you put me in before? That Memor used to study my mind?"
"No," Beemore said. "This enables you to communicate with other minds, specifically those who need you to serve as an intermediary."
"Who?"
Tan and Areev turned to Irma and Cliff.
"I hated that suffocating box with its foul smell, and the feeling, like snakes swarming over my skull, then fingers in my head. I'd think something, then it slipped away as if something was running greasy hands over it."
"We require you to enter this device,"
Osanoth said. She turned to Beemore and said in folk, but not so fast that Tan and Areev could not translate it,
"Do we need the others? They are trouble."
Beemore rattled suppressing signals with his hind feathers.
"Not now."
Cliff and Irma had caught none of this. She said,
"Look, I can't square that great shame history of yours. You came back from star voyaging to see the old place, Earth, so why haven't we found folk artifacts on other planets in the solar system?"
"There were stages. There was the era after the Great Shame that earlier folk forms called the Dusting. It was a rain of small fragments into the solar system, an after effect of the Shame, in ways known to orbital specialists, arising from multiple asteroid collisions far out from Sol. A sad era. Mere high-velocity dust destroyed much space-based technology. It etched whole cities out of existence on worlds not protected by atmospheres."
"But enough of this," Beemore said. "Into this device you go now, late invader. We are ordered to send you thus, for reasons opaque to me. The ice mines would have it so. Welcome to this,"
a broad sweeping gesture with a final feathered flourish,
"a singular machine which we term a reader."
She had no choice. The assistants looked nasty, and they moved swiftly, closing in on her. She turned and embraced the people near her.
"Damn, we've just reunited, and...
"We'll still be here when you come out." The others gave murmuring reassurances. She turned to follow the assistant, some nervous little form of robot. And suddenly, a loud thunderclap hammered through the room. The fleshy walls of the skyfish rippled with it, and the floor lurched beneath her. She staggered, caught herself on Irma's shoulder, stayed standing.
"Damn!"
"A shockwave,"
Cliff said. He turned to the folk.
"From what?"
Beemore looked out the transparent wall.
"Disaster,"